It is fascinating, as I cannot help but comment on it, when you see political platforms established where morality is completely jettisoned and freedom takes priority over right and wrong, and the only moral right left in this world, in our world anyway, is the moral right of freedom, which is an illusion. There is no such thing as absolute freedom. It's a contradiction in terms, just as there is no such thing as free love.
If you suddenly found yourself before an audience of important government leaders, how would you communicate with them? How do you think they would respond to you? Where does the message of the Bible fit in with government and citizenship? Hello, and welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring apologist Ravi Zacharias. We're glad you're with us today for the second half of Ravi's message, Bridging Two Worlds. Many times the Apostle Paul found himself before men of great influence, and the way that he communicated with them was absolutely marvelous. Today we'll continue our look at one incident found in Acts chapter 24, in which Paul interacts with a Roman leader, Felix. As Ravi describes it, Paul's method was brilliant. Last week we saw that Paul started off with a point of reference. He found some common ground for discussion, a necessity for us today as well, whether we're communicating with people in government like Paul was, or whether we're trying to reach the person next door. Now, here's Ravi recapping last week's broadcast before concluding his message, Bridging Two Worlds.
Look at a modern-day journalist describing our time, Steve Turner, the English journalist who does a masterful job of sarcastically describing our day, and you can see Rome all over again. You love this. Listen to it. He says, "We believe in Marx, Freud, and Darwin. We believe everything is okay, as long as you don't hurt anyone, to the best of your definition of hurt, and to the best of your definition of knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin. We believe that adultery is fun. We believe that sodomy is okay. We believe that taboos are taboo. We believe that everything's getting better despite evidence to the contrary. The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in horoscopes, UFOs, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man, just like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although we think his good morals were really bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same. At least the one that we read was. They all believe in love and goodness. They only differ on matters of creation, sin, heaven, hell, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes the nothing, because when you ask the dead what happens, they say nothing. If death is not the end, and if the dead have lied, then it's compulsory heaven for all, excepting perhaps Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in Masters and Johnson. What's selected is average, what's average is normal, what's normal is good. We believe in total disarmament. We believe there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. We believe that man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions. Conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him, and reality will adapt accordingly. The universe will readjust. History will alter. We believe that there is no absolute truth except the truth that there is no absolute truth. We believe in the rejection of creeds and the flowering of individual thought." And then he adds this postscript, "If chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, troops on rampage, youths go looting, bomb blast school, it is but the sound of man worshipping his maker." So you and I may boast today of the greatest nation on earth. And I have to wonder if that would be God's estimate. I don't know. We have certainly become the most violent nation on earth, so that our young people cannot even go to schools without fear, or our teachers without fear of being attacked. The sound of man worshiping his maker. What Rome signified then, we signify now. I look at Paul, and I can only look at him briefly. I give you three lessons I learned from him. And what I want you to notice in how Paul approached this in his methodological genius and his theological maturity. His methodological genius and his theological maturity. First, look at the methodological genius. You see, he starts off with a point of reference. He starts off with a point of reference. He tries to establish a framework within which he and the king could be talking on common terms. So often when we talk to people, we have no common point of reference. And so the first thing Paul talks about is a framework of righteousness. He talks about a framework of righteousness so that when he says good and bad, his listener will know exactly what he means. Today, if you try to establish a contact with anybody at random and use the terms good and bad, you know as well as I know, we're not talking about the same thing because they don't mean the same thing to everybody. Morals has become the most fluid term in our culture. Bertrand Russell, in his famous debate with the Jesuit priest Copleston, when Bertrand Russell was asked how he differentiates between good and bad, Russell says the same way I differentiate between blue and green. To which Copleston said, but you differentiate between blue and green by seeing, don't you? Russell says, yes. Then how do you differentiate between good and bad? Here's this brilliant Cambridge mathematician philosopher. His answer was on the basis of feeling. What else? Well, my question to Russell would have been, wait a minute, sir. In some cultures, they love their neighbors. In other cultures, they eat them, both on the basis of feeling. Do you have any personal preference? How do you establish a framework? There must be a common point of setting. Let me give you another illustration. Do you know how philosophy comes into your life and mine? It comes in at three levels. Level one, theory. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Most of us will never crack a book open on them because for whatever reason. Level one, theory. Level two is drama. Drama. When you watch a television program of any kind today, you can be sure it brings with it a philosophical worldview. Even when you're listening to the news. You're listening to a philosophy of life. You're listening to a philosophy of life. So whether you watch the Archie Bunker or you watch any of the modern day shows, I really don't watch it. I've got so many better things to do. But whatever you watch, you're listening to a philosophy of life coming through. That's level two, the arts. Level three is when you're sitting around the kitchen table and your son says, Dad, today at school they were discussing sexual preferences. Why do you think one is right and the other is wrong? And the dad says, son, you better tell them what Romans 1 says. And the son probably gulps for the moment and says, Dad, if you don't mind my saying so, Romans 1 works around this table. It doesn't work in the classroom. Level 1 is theory. Level 2 is drama. Level 3 is kitchen table conversation. Listen to the modern day talk show hosts. They fulfill what Paul says, forever speaking, understanding nothing. But you've got three levels. You've got three levels. Listen now. You must always argue from level one, illustrate from level two, and apply at level three. Always argue from level one, illustrate from level two, apply from level three. Level one and two are completely thrown out. Level three is your preference versus my preference, and it's one like versus another like, one feeling versus another feeling. Have you ever heard a talk show host defend why anything should be right or anything should be wrong? Other than that, he thinks so. Logic is gone. I think Paul is very, very strategic because you see, the Romans came to everything by a position of law. The Greeks came to everything from a position of philosophy. The Hebrews came to everything from the virtue of the Ten Commandments, and the Christian was coming now from the person of Jesus Christ. How is he going to establish the framework of what is right and what is wrong? And he goes for the jugular and says, Felix, I want to tell you how righteousness really comes. It doesn't come from just reading the Ten Commandments, Felix. It doesn't come from just understanding truth, beauty, and goodness of the Greek categories. It is not right or wrong just because you make a law out in the Roman world. Let me tell you how I found Jesus Christ, Felix. I, as a Hebrew, tried desperately to keep the laws. I tried desperately as a philosopher to understand these concepts. If you listen to my speech at Athens, Felix, I explained all of that there. Felix, what I want to say to you is this, man has no righteousness of his own, and there's only one person whose righteousness I can point you to, and that is the person of Jesus Christ, and by faith in him, I present to you what true righteousness is all about. His message immediately focused on the person of Christ. I have no doubt about it whatsoever, because he gives his expanded treatment on righteousness by faith in the early part of the book of Romans. And to summarize that argument, I take an argument from James Stewart of Scotland, focusing on the person of Christ and his uniqueness. He says this, he was the meekest and lowliest of all the sons of men, yet he spoke of coming on the clouds of heaven with the glory of God. He was so austere that evil spirits and demons cried out in terror at his coming, yet he was so genial and winsome and approachable that the children loved to play with him and the little ones nestled in his arms. No one was half so kind or compassionate to sinners, yet no one spoke such red-hot scorching words about sin. A bruised reed he would not break, his whole life was love, yet on one occasion he demanded the Pharisees how they they were expected to escape the damnation of hell. He was a dreamer of dreams and seer of visions. Yet for sheer stark realism, he has all of our self-styled realists soundly beaten. He was a servant of all, washing the disciples' feet. Yet masterfully he strode into the temple, and the hucksters and money changers fell over one another in their mad rush to get away from the fire they saw blazing in his eyes. He saved others, yet at the last himself he did not save. There is nothing in history like the union of contrasts which confronts us in the Gospels. The mystery of Jesus is the mystery of divine personality. Righteousness. Felix, let's get our categories clear and let's start from the same starting point. Many times when I'm on a university campus, somebody will turn to me and say, what's wrong with such and such? And I stop them right there because they're moving me to level 3 to make an application. I move them back right to level 1 and say, could you first tell me if anything is wrong with anything? And all of a sudden, they've got to set up their structures. And they know they've got their backs to the wall then. First, righteousness. Secondly, relevance. A point of righteousness, a point of relevance. He goes from righteousness to self-control. Do you think Felix found it relevant to be talked to about self-control? So first, I think the focus was on Jesus Christ. Second was the focus, I believe, on the Spirit. And I'll tell you why. Paul in Romans 1 says, that which I wanted to do, I did not do. That which I did not want to do, I ended up doing. That which I ended up doing, I despised. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? Is there a way? Thanks be to God. Yes, there is. And he talks about the presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives. See, outside of the Spirit of God, self-control I don't think is really possible beyond a certain point. Let me illustrate it. I'm not an engineer. If any engineer is here, think I'm off, please forgive me and correct me afterwards here. Concrete is very good for a foundation up to a point. It has immense under compressive strength. It can take enormous compressive strength. But concrete has no tension strength. And that's why when you build a foundation, you don't just build it with concrete, you reinforce it with steel, because steel's tensile strength there is about 10 times greater than concrete's. And what concrete cannot do under tension, the steel does for the concrete under tension. The concrete can take the weight in its compressive strength, the steel provides the tension strength, and that's why reinforced concrete provides that double strength we need. The human will, up to a point, can take the pressures of this world. You need the indwelling of the Holy Spirit to give you the strength to have self-control. And you know, I don't mean self-control just in terms of sensuality. We need self-control in many other ways too. I won't extensively illustrate it. Let me just give you one. I was in London, England, speaking to a group of Muslim converts from the Iranian Christian Fellowship, one of the greatest groups anywhere on the face of the earth. I always come back from there more blessed than any blessing I could impart. And they invited a small handful out of this large group, about 20 or 25, for a luncheon with me. Several of them Muslim converts. And I was in the kitchen helping myself to some food. And there were two American missionaries who looked like in their mid-60s who were sitting in that living room there. And I say this to you truthfully. When I looked at their faces, they reminded me of a little bit of maybe what Moses looked like when he came down from the mount. They had the presence of Christ radiating in their lives. And ironically, their last name was Bliss. And I went to the back room and I said to one of the Muslim converts, how do you know the Blisses? Do you know what he said to me? He said, I came to know them when I was to be picked up for a children's church meeting many, many years ago in Tehran and decided to go and play instead. So the Blisses came, some friends came, picked up the Blisses' three children, two or three other little boys from the neighborhood, and they were driving 100 miles or so to go for some camp or some meeting, I forget what it was. On the way, that car met with a head-on collision, and all of their three children were killed instantly. Can you imagine dad or mom in one solitary moment to have your whole family just wiped off only as a memory? How would you and I carry it? I have no doubt they must have spent thousands of weeping and lonely hours in their bed. But as these two great American missionaries in Tehran exemplified it, there were so many in that room who said they came to know Christ because of what they had seen in the life of the Bliss family. Self-control rather than anger, which may have been legitimate at a point, rather than confusion, which may have been religious. Now the beaming face of their children in the faith. So I want us to apply it beyond. Here you've got a point of relevance, a point of reference, and lastly, a point of disturbance. He talked to him about the judgment that was to come. And you know what it says? Felix trembled and said, you better get out of here. I'll talk to you later. You've got to be very careful when you bring out the point of disturbance. But at some point it has to come. Jesus brought the point of disturbance with the woman at the well. He brought the point of disturbance with the Pharisees. He brought the point of disturbance with the rich young ruler. He brought the point of disturbance with Nicodemus. Everyone Jesus met with, he found a bridge, then all of a sudden he began to rattle one of those foundations and said, "Where are you?" Nobody, no leader today likes to hear about judgment, do they? Because leaders resent accountability. They do not like to think they're accountable to anyone. And here Paul says, "Felix, you're going to stand in judgment." And if you want to know what Paul thinks about judgment, read Romans again. You've got all of the context that you would have presented. I just want to close by saying this. The fascinating thing to me is how Felix responded. He shook with fear, but he didn't do away with Paul immediately. What do you think Felix tried to do? You read about it. He was hoping Paul would bribe him. If you cannot deal with the message, try to destroy the messenger. If you cannot deal with the message, try to destroy the messenger. Are we any different to Rome? But Paul stuck to his guns, did not take the bribe. Because of Paul, he got to Caesar's household. And when you read some of his epistles, he's sending his greetings to those in Caesar's household. Because of the conversion of Rome, Europe opened up. And may I dare suggest to you, because of the conversion of Rome and the opening of Europe, Islam had a barricade set in its way, or the whole of Europe would have been conquered by the world of Islam too. Marvelous movement, marvelous movement. And so I think today, as I apply, of some of you businessmen here, where all of your colleagues live with constant secularism, of the many doctors here who are living under greater pressure than you've ever lived before, where you're almost expected to be divine and one little slip can destroy your career, of the lawyers here who struggle with the fact that law has taken priority over goodness or morality or ethics, can I make two applications and then move to the more practical ones here and weave them in later? Here it is. I think God, in his marvelous wisdom, finds us spots and niches in life that we would never have dreamed of, but he's placed us like a grain of salt to penetrate the insipid surroundings in which we live. And if you keep salt in a salt shaker, it's no good. When you put it into the soup, even though the soup dissolves it, the soup never tastes the same again. He puts us very uniquely. Let me give you the two illustrations. David Ekman of Time magazine, when I was speaking at Washington, my wife and I went to hear him one afternoon. He was one of the seminar leaders, one of the most powerful testimonies I'd ever heard from a journalist. David Ekman is a brilliant Englishman, a senior foreign affairs correspondent for Time. And David Ekman told the story. I can just shrink it for you. He said he was on Hong Kong in assignment. And he, by the way, is their Sovietologist. All of the major stories coming out of Soviet Union are David Ekman's. He was in Hong Kong for a story, and he said he had a foul-mouthed correspondent to work with. He was using the name of Christ, punctuated in every sentence, and just dirty in his language. And David Ekman, in his English restraint, finally looked at him one day when he used the name of Christ three or four times within a matter of moments. He said, "Excuse me, I don't like the way you use the name of my God." And he said, the man just looked at me and said, "Excuse me, I don't like the way you just said that." And a wall came between them, and Ekman could no longer communicate to him. Ekman said, "I lay in bed after many days, and I said, 'Lord, I've lost my bridge. I've lost my opportunity to witness. What can I do?' He said, with trembling, I walked into his office the next day filled with smoke, and I said to him, 'Can I say something to you? You know what happened with us a few days ago? It was completely my fault. I'm sorry. It had nothing to do with you. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? And secondly, can I say something?' He said, 'If you and I are battling for the same story, you want it and I want it, from here on, let's establish a rule. You get first choice. If you want the story, you do it. If you don't want the story, I'll do it.'" Think of the courage of David Ekman. Ekman said he was stunned. A few weeks later, a Christian businessman was speaking in Hong Kong. And he said, I went over to him and said, "Would you like to go with me for a breakfast? There's a Christian gathering of business people." He said, "All right." And at the end of that breakfast, this man committed his life to Christ. He said, he's got a long way to go. He's got a long way to go. I understand that. I deal on a secular level too. But isn't it good how Ekman found the bridge back to be the salt and not just to be the disturber? He found the point of reference. And I close with a simple illustration that will touch your heart and mine. It's true, the story I'm going to tell you. Yugoslavia now needs to hear this story. The church has to bear the responsibility for many decades of what Yugoslavia is all about, by the way. If you've read anything about the history of the church in Yugoslavia, they were some of the biggest culprits and scoundrels and murderers in the early days of the church there. And there was an older man by the name of Zimmerman living in a little village, and an evangelist by the name of Yakov. And this story, by the way, is told in the book entitled Of Whom the World Was Not Worthy, written by Marie Capian. And she says, Zimmerman, this older man, was angry and bitter against the church, and a young evangelist by the name of Yakov came to him one day and started to witness to him about Christ. And Zimmerman said, I don't want to hear you talking about Christ anymore. I don't want you to mention his name. I'm not interested in your gospel. Do you know what your Christ has done to my family? He talked about his nephew that had been murdered by the church and all that had gone on, the shenanigans gone on in the hierarchy of the church. He said, don't mention his name here. And the church and the priests are all corrupt. So Yaakov said, can I ask you a question, Zimmerman, and then I'll go? You say the church and the priests are all corrupt, therefore you don't believe the gospel. Can I ask you a question? He said, Zimmerman, if I took your coat and your shoes and put on your coat and your shoes and went into town and stole from a store and came back and hid, and a policeman in the distance looked to see who the thief was and all he saw was your coat and your shoes and came running to your home and said, Zimmerman, I saw you stealing from that store, and you say it wasn't me. And he says, I saw you. I saw your coat. It was your coat and your shoes. What are you going to say? He said, I'm going to tell him it wasn't me. He'll say, but he saw your coat. He says, all right, Yaakov, I know what you're driving at. I don't want to hear anymore. Yaakov left, but every year he came and visited Zimmerman, talked to him, lived before him. And one day Zimmerman bent his knee on the soil there and gave his life to Christ. And when he got up, he wiped the tears away and he looked at Yaakov, embraced him and said, thank you for coming and giving me the gospel. You wear his coat well. You wear his coat well. Paul found that point of reference, the point of relevance, and the point of disturbance. Felix thought he would decimate him by giving him the wrong coat. But Paul wore his coat well. Let us never assume that separation from the world in its morality means isolation from the world in its physicality. We need to be close to those who despise his name so we can give to them the coat of Christ through the reference, through the relevance, ultimately the disturbance, and let God bring about the conviction. Thank you. May God bless you. That's our word of prayer. Father, thank you. Thank you for the reminder of your truth. We look at Russia today, never dreaming that we'd see what's happening. And yet after 70 years, some have worn your coat so well, so that the leaders are astounded and the name is being honored again. I think of China, where Mao tried to brutalize your people. Today your name is exalted in many, many lives, tens of millions out there. Thank you for the privilege of living in America. And in spite of all of our liabilities, O God, will you not honor the faith of the many who love you in this land, including many of our political leaders and many of key people in tough surroundings? Lord, I strongly suspect that's why you continue to honor your name here, because so many are still the salt. Make us great in your eyes, for that's really what matters. Bless your people today in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you, Ravi. Well, where has God placed you in life? Who could you reach out to with the love of Christ? Ravi reminded us that God puts us in places in life where we can reach others. And in the analogy of the salt shaker, when we find ourselves positioned to season the world around us, we've got to pour ourselves out. In Ravi's words, we should never assume that separation from the world means isolation. We've got to be close to those who don't know God so that they can see the beauty of Christ. Today's broadcast is available as part of a 3-CD album. When ordering, ask for CD 304, titled Leadership and the Political Arena. Again, that's CD 304, titled Leadership and the Political Arena. If you'd like to place a credit card order, call us at 1-800-448-6766. Again, that's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. If you prefer using the Internet, go to rzim.org. That's rzim.org. Our online resource center is an interactive, user-friendly way to preview and order products. In addition, you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. Once again, the website is rzim.org. If you'd like to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia 30010. In Canada, write to 50 Gervais Drive, Suite 315, Toronto, Ontario, M3C1Z3. The Canadian address once again is 50 Gervais Drive, Suite 315, Toronto, Ontario, M3C1Z3. Please be sure to give us the call letters of this station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.